and welcome to the Happy Baby Podcast. The Happy Baby Podcast is hosted by Frank Kelleher. Frank is one of the best known paediatric osteopaths in Ireland. Over the last 20 years, he has helped well over 10,000 families with some of the most common issues that can challenge babies and children. The Happy Baby Podcast is all about providing information for parents on the common issues that can affect their baby or child, and more importantly, where to get help. Our aim is to provide parents with good, practical, professional information to help them navigate their little one's health needs more effectively. This podcast is not, however, intended as a substitute for medical diagnosis or treatment from a qualified health professional. If you have any concerns about your child, you should contact the appropriate health professional. In this episode of the Happy Baby Podcast, Frank is talking with Una Buckley from Blossom for Life about dyslexia. Una is a trained dyslexic tutor and assessor and works with students on a one-to-one basis, providing tailored multi-sensory programs. She is passionate about changing the experience of others who face similar challenges as she did. Una describes herself as being severely dyslexic. Her own journey through education was a challenging and lonely one. She experienced anxiety and bullying and remembers spending hours doing her homework each night. Because of this, she is uniquely placed to understand the challenges faced by children with dyslexia. In this episode, Una talks about homework, different learning styles, and gives us so many tips to improve a child's learning environment and ability. Una's website has so much information for parents of children with dyslexia and is a valuable resource for information to help support your child. You can find Una at www.blossomforlife.com and on Instagram at blossomforlife.
Delighted today to be down in a lovely Kinsale to talk to Una Buckley. I'm just overlooking the sea out here and it looks a fantastic view. So we're in Una's house today to talk about what she does and how she works with people. So Una, you're very welcome to the Happy Baby Podcast, and please tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Thanks for having me, Frank, and thanks, Rose. So delighted to be on board. So a bit about my own background. So I am highly dyslexic. I would have had my own challenges in school and through college and third level, and kind of realised, I suppose, as I finished college, you know, this is definitely a space that I wanted to get a bit more involved in. Okay. Naturally, though, kind of went down different routes for the first year or two, like all of us, got into the corporate space for a while and then realised, actually, you know, this is something I wanted to pursue with working with, you know, children and kids with different ways of learning. So thankfully, in about 3.5 years in business, so kind of late 2018, early 2019, I set up Blossom for Life, which works directly with students with different ways of learning, dyslexia, autism, and the whole way through. So we primarily work on a one-to-one basis. We also do group classes and group dynamics. But generally speaking, it's very specialised tuition and support to help them get through their milestones or onto their next goals.
And would it be quite a cross-age group in terms of...
Pretty much, yeah. So we, like, our youngest at the moment is about 5, and we go all the way up to, we have an adult over the last while in the 60s. So we go the whole way through, really, from all different aspects. And it's always about, I suppose, that constant learning and developing and how we can, you know, flourish and move forward, you know. So that's hopefully what we help them with.
Great. And what is dyslexia? Tell me what it is.
Dyslexia is a broad, okay, I think, overarching term, to be honest. I think the definition, thankfully, of dyslexia has drastically changed over the last many, many years through various researches and further details. However, generally speaking, dyslexia is primarily linked to a reading, you know, a spelling, you know, difficulty overall. Now, under the dyslexia banner, we have dysgraphia, which links in with an issue with your handwriting. So lots of people may be dyslexic and may also have dysgraphia. Okay. And then we have another strand, which is dyscalculia. So lots of people may also be dyslexic and have dyscalculia, which is a tie-in with your maths. So generally speaking, the stereotypical side of dyslexia is, you know, coordination, handwriting, spelling, reading, difficulty sequencing rhymes, anything as a child, and can go the whole way through. But unfortunately, it can present in different ways in different kids and different students. But the definition in theory has evolved to encompass lots of different things that as we develop from an evolution basis.
Okay, and you mentioned just the word presenting, how dyslexia presents. Can you elaborate a little bit on that? And just things that maybe parents need to look out for, or indeed if you are an adult going through the school system and you're struggling a little bit.
So in theory, dyslexia would have been like commonly linked to letter reversals. So I myself would have struggled greatly with B's and D's and P's and Q's. I remember endless hours spent on the weekend trying to learn my B's and D's and my P's and Q's. So that can still be there, and that can still be represented in kids and also in adults or back to school learners. However, the definition has evolved. So it can, you know, it mightn't have any impact from that side. Students and kids might have a great, you know, spelling capacity and get on very well in spelling. Yes, their memory could be really difficult. So their short term and longer term memory or their phonics could be really difficult. You know, it is so specific that it's very hard, I suppose, to pinpoint. But some common signs would be obviously, you know, directions at a young age, telling them go down here now and go left and right, and then they get totally lost. Or obviously issues between their left and the right side of the body. So if they're left-handed, they're not knowing which hand they write with. At the moment, there's a lot of issues with learning the clock, actually, for kids. Actually, kids in general, really, we're finding that. But kids with different ways of learning, I find it very difficult to move between the analogue and the digital clock, and finding that process very, very challenging. And another red flag would be money. So actually counting money, there's loads of money sums in all of the recent primary school books. So mental maths and busy at maths, they're forever filled with money questions. Okay. John goes to the shop and he buys this, all these classic money questions. Yes. They can be very, very difficult to actually, they can't actually logically compute how do we put all of these things together. So that those could present in students obviously also with not a different way of learning. It's just that there could be a combination of maybe five or six things that they feel right. Oh, these are all, you know, issues at the moment where then it would need to, I suppose, be followed up on.
Talk to me a little bit about different learning styles in terms of, is it that the brain's ability to look at things or to learn in a certain way has changed? And is it that you have to use different learning styles to try and cope with that?
Primarily with students with different ways of learning, we would opt with a multi-sensory approach to trying to learn. So as much incorporation of your senses as possible. Now, in theory, we have seven different learning styles. So we have visual, I try to remember them all, visual, verbal, solitary, social, and physical and logical. So we have lots of different ways that we learn and we pick up things. People are very hands-on. Some people need a combination of all strategies. And I suppose it's about trying to invest that time to find out, firstly, what learning style actually suits. So what is the best way that that particular person learns? There's loads of, you know, online free assessments that people can log into to try and find out what's their optimal way of learning. And then working within that, you know, if they're doing their homework or they're preparing for a test, right, how do they actually study pieces of this information? And what's the best use of their time instead of, you know, trying to write something out and that's not the best way that they learn. So it's about trying to find out what the style is first and then actually then trying to implement it on a day-to-day basis.
And do you do that when you work with them through an assessment process? And I mean, getting to a diagnosis of what's going on, is that how it works?
Primarily so. So I would work with students to try and determine what their learning style is and then how we can work with them on a day-to-day or a weekly week or, you know, even a term-to-term basis to try and, you know, see what they need to achieve and how do we need to move them forward. If they're younger kids, just might be about simple multiplication tables or simple maths or simple spellings. Obviously, if then they're leaving cert or they're, you know, college students, there's a different dynamic with that.
Really. Yeah, and what happens then when you've done the assessment process, they come and work with you for a period of time and you teach them the different styles?
Primarily so. So we would work with students generally, you know, on a set basis. So we might take them for a few weeks at a time and then they might take a break. Obviously, some students, if they're behind, you know, an education system and then the curriculum, they will stay for us for a longer period of time and we'll work with them, you know, to carry out their homework more effectively, you know, and work in the routine. And obviously, we bring in a huge overall holistic standpoint to the children. So we monitor their sleep pattern. Oh, we engage with their overall well-being, activities, food, nutrition. So my background is also in food and my master's in food. So I would do a lot with them on the overall process of how they actually approach schoolwork instead of it just being, you have to learn this and you have to produce it in an exam. It's very important to look at the person as an actual person, I suppose, I feel, instead of a robot, you know, so we try and take them in as a full person instead of just a silo event of education.
So very holistic approach, really.
Pretty much. Yeah. It's really trying to, you know, take them as they are and how do we move them forward with whatever they've got going on outside of school or whatever they, you know, difficulties they had growing up or any, you know, impacts or, you know, anxiety levels obviously are through the roof. A, since the pandemic, but B, prior to that, there's a huge tie between students with learning difficulties and a mental health issue, even if there wasn't a pandemic.
Right.
So there's a very strong case for a lot of students having, you know, anxiety or depression, either currently or in later life, if, you know, certain measures aren't put in place. So we try to catch that as early as possible so that we can prevent them from going down a difficult path.
Okay. And are the parents, their teachers involved with this? Do you liaise with those people
pretty much,
as well?
Yeah. So it depends on the family circumstances. Let's say in one family unit, we might actually take two or three children from the same family if they all have different ways of learning. Okay. So we would be very obviously involved with the student themselves. Generally, their parents, obviously, we would liaise with them on a week-to-week basis anyway, with making sure they're, you know, meeting milestones and on top of everything. And then some parents will link us in with the school or the let's say the year head if it's secondary school, or the primary school teacher if they want us to create more of that loop. Ideally, it's best to have a parent and the school involved, but sometimes that's not always possible.
And so how can teachers help kids with dyslexia or even teenagers? How does that work? Do they have to talk to people like you? Do they have to do special training?
I suppose that's a broad perspective as well. So we would carry out a lecture and a teacher training program. So let's say across the ETBs at the moment in the universities, we run a 3 week, which is, you know, not for the full 3 weeks. We do a set amount of hours each week to help train teachers and train lecturers in actually how to work with students on a direct basis. I suppose for hopefully teachers listening in that aren't availing of that, it'd be generally about, right, how do we set the space up as effectively as possible? How, you know, do they navigate through the classroom? Is things easily labelled, signposted? We have colours, but also limiting distractions so that there's not, you know, things additionally in the classroom that don't need to be there, but that they're not like catching the students' attention. And then it's about, I suppose, the day-to-day activities of giving out instructions, giving out homework, making sure as much as possible that those students, right, who have number 5 to number 10 summed out tonight, and making sure that they actually know what that is.
Okay.
Now, unfortunately, obviously, when they're young, there needs to be a bit more of that hand-holding. A lot of the students over the last while are forgetting bringing home their books and, you know, everything and anything with that. And that's up to, obviously, the teacher themselves. There's only so much obviously they can do in the day with, you know, 20 odd kids in the classroom. They're very, very stretched. Yes. So it's important to, I suppose, take that into consideration. But also there's a lot of small things that just can be done. You know, a lot of easy tips and tricks. We would say about, let's say, carrying out homework or giving out homework instructions, anything that can be done in a picture format instead of always writing everything down, which can take longer. And obviously, if they have difficulty spelling, that can be very difficult to understand what they do for homework. So any alternative ways of actually delivering the same amount of information, but just making, you know, their life and also the student life a bit easier can make a big, big impact, really.
Very good. And are there skills that can be taught to help with study and, say, doing exams? I'm talking about the older groups now, really.
Yeah, so for primarily for our secondary school and our college students, there are an awful lot of obviously study skills seminars and sessions that we would work directly with the student or in a group format on. So directly with the student, again, the first part is understanding, I suppose, what their learning style is as to how to set them up straight away for study. We do a lot on setting the space and making sure the space works for them. So obviously their chair, the desk, limiting clutter, all of those things actually have a big impact on all of us, actually.
Yeah, okay.
But can be really distracting for a student with a different way of learning. They'll be like, well, we'll fix all of this stuff, and there's 2 hours later gone by when they, you know, we're supposed to be studying. So it's about setting the environment up first, ideally as well in a separate space as much as possible to the bedroom. So that's even just a separate space at a corner of a different room. We try and, I suppose, take it out of the bedroom dynamic so that it doesn't impact with their sleep pattern. And then it's about, I suppose, setting up and establishing some form of a routine. So are they doing it, you know, a small few minutes every day? Are they doing it in a chunk at the weekend if they've after school activities? how best is it going to work in terms of scheduling, and then how is it going to actually be allocated in terms of time? So how are we going to split out the subjects if they've 6 or 7 subjects on, you know, to sit their leaving cert? What are the top priorities now and what are the top chapters? So it takes a bit of time to do all, I suppose, that logistics, yes, and preparation in terms of what we need to do now, what we need to catch up on. And then, you know, obviously the routinely practicing exam questions and that type of thing. But once we understand, I suppose, the learning style first, then we would move forward as to how best to work with them.
Okay, very good. And in the exam situations, do some students need to get exemptions or support when they're actually doing the exams? Is that something that...
Yeah, so I suppose in terms of the exemption side, so generally students with dyslexia or different ways of learning, if they fall within a certain criteria, you can avail of an Irish exemption, and then you can avail of obviously a third language exemption that's needed maybe if you go on to college or universities.
Okay.
In terms of exam setup, so there's lots of different services that are offered both at junior cert and leaving cert level. Now it's a slightly different criteria in terms of if you're going to third level, that's a bit less rigorous. You don't need as much, thankfully, dotted T's and paperwork. But for, let's say, junior cert and leaving cert, there's lots of different setups. So obviously you can get a laptop, you can get your spelling and grammar waiver, you could get a reader, you know, that would read out the paper to you, and then you'd be in a separate room and a separate centre. There's lots on. Obviously you could get a scribe. Unfortunately, if anybody, you know, broke their hand the week before, can get a scribe. So there are a lot of things, but there is, I suppose, it's about kind of jumping over hurdles to maybe get to those at times, depending upon how well the education psychology support is laid out.
Okay. You mentioned technology like laptops. How can technology help, and what's the availability of technology now to support those kids and those teenagers, really?
Yeah, so I suppose the main way forward, really, in terms of students with different ways of learning, is going to be to leverage the technology as much as possible. So the last, let's say, even 5 to 6 years, obviously technology has vastly grown regardless.
Yes.
But definitely in this space, it is massively accelerated as we, you know, evolve a society. More and more people will be assessed, more and more people will be determined, let's say, of having a different way of learning. So it will be a way forward from a business and a financial perspective, where more and more businesses will jump on this, let's say, trend anyway. So we've ever increasing amount of apps. So like obviously you can download on Android and iOS for reading and spelling and helping kids and teenagers and even adults on a day to day, even a brain training capacity to stay up to date with any of those pieces of information. And then you've got traditional pieces, obviously, of, you know, dictate functions and read and write and software that can obviously buy and install onto a laptop or install onto a desktop. So it's about becoming as familiar as you can with pieces of those technologies. But then generally speaking, we don't suggest a huge amount to be installed for a particular person, because they can just get really overwhelmed, and you can actually spend a fair bit of money getting a load of pieces of software and not actually using them. I myself has loads, you know, and I give some of them to the kids, and then actually, you know, day to day, I don't really use them at all, you know, and they're just there, they're sitting idle. There's probably no point in me having some of them. So generally speaking, we would generally suggest maybe 2, at the most 3, either, you know, a tangible piece or a piece on the computer that they would use on a regular basis that would help them in homework or help them in study.
You mentioned sort of that your background is in nutrition as well. And obviously my question, sort of, if you want to talk a little bit about how you use nutrition to help in a holistic approach. And as well as that, are there other therapies or people that you'll call upon to help these kids and these teenagers as well? Perfect. As they sort of go down their path, really?
Yeah, well, I suppose to answer your second question first, because I'll probably forget who are the other people. So definitely the occupational therapist side is really big.
Okay.
And that's become ever increasingly important for students with different ways of learning, because the dysgraphia assessment, so when you have an issue with your handwriting, now often isn't done by education psychologists. You generally now would have to go to an OT and get an assessment through that way. Lots of students that we would work with would both have linked to it with an OT and would have linked with an education psychologist. Okay. Whereas myself, when I was obviously assessed, maybe 10, 15 years ago, there was no mention of an occupation therapist. Actually, I had no understanding of what even OTs did.
Right.
So it's just, I suppose, that evolving space now that's become more and more important. Definitely the nutrition side, obviously, you know, if people are very involved in that space, or a child is at severe, you know, eating differences or different dynamics, that can be really useful. I'm trained from a kinesiology standpoint, so I really think that holistic mindset really does help, but obviously in a confined fashion. And then the traditional, let's say, speech and language therapy or anything from that side, if a child is really young and presenting those symptoms, that would be really important. And from my own side, I loved the whole like food space anyway. So okay. I was very fortunate to have a really great teacher to teach me home ec when I was in school. And it was just a joy to pick up. I still have the book actually there on the shelf. I love when some of the kids come on and they're like doing home ec. I'm like, great, sorted. Yeah. Love doing that. It's just a walk in the park for me. So when I did my first degree, we got to do bits of food in that. But thankfully, then I went on to study it a bit more. From my side, I feel it has a huge impact because obviously, you know, the whole gut and brain connection,
yes,
which we won't all get into. But obviously, the chemical composition of us, to set us up really for learning in a particular way, we really need to have the right fuel and the right energy to be able to do that. And if we're putting not so great stuff into our body, we're going to produce not so great stuff out. So now, thankfully, I think there's a huge push on the whole healthy eating in schools. But I remember when I was in school, I was totally addicted to chocolate, that we'd be bringing in chocolate, like, and having chocolate at all breaks, you know, whereas now I think the small kids that we work with, you know, they don't have any of that. And like, even by Friday, sometimes they're now even hesitant to have anything. So I do think there's a shift which will affect their overall concentration and capabilities. But I think that needs to be regularly monitored also at home, and how much can be pushed into that space.
And you spoke about sleep as well and the importance of it. What's your thinking on that?
Well, again, that's just from a personal background, really, that I had a very difficult time as a child getting to sleep from a concentration standpoint. So our brains are so chemically wired so much throughout the day, and you're often so tasked to try and process information and produce information that you can get to that overtired stage.
Yes.
But then you get to the second wind kind of stage where you've just loads of energy. So I constantly went through that as a child.
Okay.
Like 8, 9, 10 o'clock, I was wired then again and I couldn't get to sleep. So I just recognise the impact that that has had on me as I, let's say, moved through. And as I then didn't, I suppose, look after myself majorly when I was in school or in college doing exams, I was cutting down, I'll get less and less sleep. And then I was noticing actually the effect that would have on my work and the level we produce. I think from working with students over the last while, particularly with the pandemic and everything, we see obviously how much more stretched people are and how much more stretched kids have been, you know, with anxiety issues or with separation issues, that sleep is really vital to do some element of recharge, rejuvenation as much as possible. So we would be very rigorous on particularly our secondary school students on, you know, sometimes think, oh, we can get 7 hours and they're fine. And I'm really like, no, you know, we try and push them up to at least 9 if possible, if not even more. And we just see the drastic difference, you know, in their humour, in their mood, in their behaviour at home, in their behaviour at school, in their ability to retain information and their just ability to remember stuff, or they'll remember their questions they had for homework instead of just being dazed and, you know, just not being able to engage as much.
Okay, yeah, that's very good, because in my line of work as an osteopath, I would see young children who have really poor sleeping patterns, and very often there is a connection to their nutritional status as well. So they may have poor appetites, they may have, and we discussed it last week, the safe foods where they'll only eat very particular foods. But also, as well as that, their sleep patterns are really affected by that. So you're dead right, they're going to sleep with very high cortisol levels and very low melatonin levels because they haven't slept well during the daytime. And therefore, they're waking frequently at night and not going into those deep patterns of sleep.
Definitely.
So I would see that clinically.
Yeah.
And that sort of ties in with what you're saying, really.
Definitely.
And it affects learning.
As you were saying, it massively affects that. And I think I'm sure you'd agree the growth as well in terms of food intolerances is ever increasing.
Oh, it is indeed.
You know, and from an evolution standpoint, we'll have more and more people that are allergic to wheat or allergic to gluten, or, you know, dairy, or even just intolerant.
Indeed.
And I think, you know, again, in our younger generation, I definitely shouldn't have been eating that much dairy.
Okay.
And it was never a thing that was even mentioned, or, you know, it was never, you know, even a thing that was flagged. And now we see it nearly in every second kid. I can see drastically their impact, you know, quite immediately, actually, when they've either had, you know, a load of sugar or they've had a load of chocolate before they come to me, and their wave in terms of emotions and concentration. So I do think that the nutrition side is going to be, you know, paramount to how we, I suppose, navigate through and as we evolve, definitely.
Yeah, very good. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about now in terms of the services or your links with other services locally and stuff like that?
Yeah, so I think really from my standpoint, it generally is to have as much impact as possible. Really is where kind of I'm at now. Thankfully, we've, you know, set up a quite a well established a unit and work very fortunately with so many different kids of different backgrounds that it's about now trying to, I suppose, you know, help actually move kids forward and help move students forward in the best possible way for them. It's really about trying to actually, you know, give people a voice that don't really have that much of a voice or feel over time that their voices weren't heard. There's kind of that tendency in school where you just have to, you know, blend in and all just, you know, be quite submissive, you know, and do the homework a certain way and behave a certain way. And, you know, there's always that blending in. And I think recently we did a segment on the whole intuition piece. And it's something I'm really passionate about because for myself and for students that I work with, as we move through school, we often forget to link in with our own tuition because we've been blended into an education system or into a school that you kind of don't have a say, you know, and you're not really given your own voice as to how you want to do things. And then we wonder why kids are getting to 15 and 16 and 17 and have no idea what career path or college education path they want to take because we've spent so much of our lives being told you have to do it this way and you have to go do that job now because that will help you or you'll get this amount of money. And it's not actually linking in with what they actually want to do. You know, it's all external validation and external people. And I realized even through college, I lived an awful lot of my life by trying to get approval from everybody else of I should do this course because that would be good. Or, you know, I have to go to this college because people tell me I have to go here. And I did all of those things and they've stood to me and I'm really, really grateful for it. And I am very thankful I've been able to navigate through in the way that I have. But I think it's just really important that you develop and kind of link back in with yourself, you know, and develop more of their own instincts. And from young kids now, I think them being able to articulate, you know, that they are dyslexic or they do have a different way of learning and they can wear that more confidently, let's say, than mine or your generation could, can really help with them, you know, instilling their confidence and instilling their own, let's say, values.
Yeah, very important. And I think, as you said, the key thing is that people have different styles of learning and they use their senses in very different ways to make that learning happen. And I think what you're talking about is giving them hopefully as many choices as possible to be able to express those different learning styles if that's how they learn about the world around them.
Exactly, and I think today we're so fortunate with so many different, you know, facilities and services and so much technology that there's so much, you know, valuable resources out there, both either paid or even in a free format. And it's just about trying to, I suppose, hone things down to what is specific, what is useful, and just baby steps. We do an awful lot on, right, we don't need to take it all in at once. And it's really important to try not to get overwhelmed about it. But what one action can be taken, let's say today, you know, from listening to this, or what one thing now can we take on board about maybe researching something or changing bits of a diet or changing a bit of sleep? What one change really can really make a huge difference?
Make a big difference.
You know, and can be massively valuable. We have a free booklet at the moment actually on the website just providing some tips and suggestions to parents and for teachers. So if anybody's interested in that, please log in and you'll be able to just get that email directly to your email address. If you have any issues anyway, feel free to
We'll definitely put that up in the Happy Baby podcast just so people can find the link and, and get that information. That would be really good. And any final thoughts now?
Generally think, you know, people are really trying their best, you know, overall. And I think it's about, from a parent perspective and a teacher perspective, about watching the guilt. We get a lot of calls, you know, of parents being like, oh, we didn't know this. And, you know, a lot of the conversation will go for the first 5 or 6 minutes of, we should have picked this or we should have picked that. And even my own parents will still have this ongoing debate back and forth. I was very late to an assessment and they still have bits of the guilt about it because the impact and, you know, many, many years of struggle and torture from my side, you know. And it's just about recognizing that unfortunately at times they are the paths that we kind of need to take, you know. It's we can't really go back in time, we can't rewind the clock. It's about just trying to do the best that we can where we're at to move forward and recognizing, yes, that things could have been differently,
but they're not, you know, and it's about just trying to move on now, but taking the actionable steps.
Yes.
That's really important, not being like, oh, we'll just leave it now another while, and we'll leave it another while. If you're fortunate enough to have the awareness, or, you know, listen in and be like, right, these are the things that we could do. It's about then just trying to implement one or two things as much as possible that can be done to help make that change.
Una, thank you so much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you. It's lovely to link in.
No, it's great to link in, and we're delighted that you could take the time out of your busy week.
Honoured. Thank you very much.
And we'll come back and talk some more again in the future.
That would be great.
Okay.
Thanks
very much, Una.
Thank
you.
Thanks so much to Una Buckley for that amazing insight into the world of dyslexic tutoring and the supports available for children with dyslexia. If you would like more information about Una and what she does, see her website, www.blossomforlife.com, or follow her on Instagram, @blossomforlife. Thanks for listening to the Happy Baby Podcast.